Welcome to another Britflix podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Cora Linda of Space Dream Productions. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Stuart. It's great to be here.
Indeed, indeed. Now, you come on to tell us about your independent production company and also share with us three films that have impacted everything in your adult life, which is going to be fun. There's a Walt Disney movie in there that I've not seen, and I'm excited to hear all about why it's memorable to you. But first, let us talk about Space Dream Productions. Do you want to talk about what that is and why you started it?
Space Dream Productions is an independent film and music production company. And I started it because there's such a lack of, how do I say this? I worked in Hollywood for over 10 years, and I wanted to use that Hollywood knowledge and skill towards independent storytelling. Usually the path is pushed to go from independent into Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And I kind of went in the other direction. At the time I was a production designer, and I was going to be a production designer / producer, which a little different, through a little bit of a twist of fate, luck, hand of the universe, whatever you want to, however you want to call it. I ended up as a director producer, and I ended up directing our first film. It was called Names on the Wall. It's actually on Amazon now. Excellent. If anyone wants to check it out. It kind of unfolded organically. We didn't expect that film to have so much success. And then I was like, oh, let's try to make another one, and then another one, and then another one. And then fast forward 11 years, almost, I think, 40 films, 200 something award nominations, 19 something best picture winners and nominees. And it's just kind of been like this tidal wave that just kind of carried me with it. And we work to make an inclusive space. I live with several disabilities. So being my own boss means that I can make sure that I have the accommodations that I need. And it means that I can help support other people with accommodations that they need. We do have several people at the company who also live with disabilities. And because of how we run and how we operate, it doesn't affect anything as far as our production. And then as sort of social media developed and content developed and different marketing needs for different brands developed, we started offering our filmmaking services for hire, not just for films, but also for content creation.
Okay.
We don't really do commercials. Like, you're not going to see us doing like a buy shoes, but we would make content, you know, for maybe a local shoemaker who is like educating people on the importance of proper footwear, or, you know, a restaurant that is farm to table, or even just is a local restaurant that's providing jobs to the community. Like, we appreciate stories and humanity. Mm-hmm. So as long as something is genuinely supporting humanity and sharing that story, whether it's a business, a brand, an activist, a fellow artist, that's who we work to support. We've got our filmmaking sort of piece and our storytelling for other people piece. Mm.
And for you then, making that transition from, did you say production design, did you say? Mm-hmm. Making the transition from production design to producer, is that an atypical route, or is that an unusual route to get to producer?
Totally atypical. I do not know. The only other person who I know who started as a production designer is Catherine Hardwick.
Okay. So in that sense then, what do you think you benefited from having that background going into production if it's not sort of a normal routine?
Yeah. My path was very sort of atypical. I started in art department, mm-hmm. Set construction, set design. I'm a certified set rigger. I built concert stages and event stages and, you know, set pieces and things like that. And then that led me into being an art director and production designer for event production. So when you're an event producer, there's a lot of the same elements of, you know, coordinating crew, managing budgets, all of managing timelines, like that producerial skill.
Yeah.
So I had that basic background, but I didn't know as much about film production. Through the crews that I was working with, especially as a rigger, I would work with the lighting teams. Sometimes I'd be on site and I was the only rigger. And like, let's say camera needed a camera rigged. Obviously these weren't union at the time. camera needed a camera rigged, or lighting needed some lights rigged. So I would be working with the different departments. I actually fell in love with lighting, and my dream job was a gaffer. I just wanted to be a gaffer. That was it. That was all I wanted to do, is work with light. My absolute passion, and still one of my greatest joys. And through learning lighting, I then worked with camera more than just rigging, but actually like as a camera op. And it sort of enabled me to fill all of these different like pieces of knowledge on what it takes to work in a production. I did some live stage productions. I worked as a stage manager for a little while. I then worked as an event producer, more from an AV side.
Got you.
And then when it came time to start working in film, I actually worked as an actress for a little bit just because it was fun. And then moving over to a director and producer, I already had worked in literally every single department.
It sounds like it.
So it was kind of, you know, I had over 10 years of experience, all of it was hands-on, lots of apprenticeships and mentorships. So it was really easy for me to then, easy, quote unquote.
Yeah.
It was less of going from strictly production design into producer. It was, I had a background in production from an event side. I'd worked with all the different departments. I understood a lot of different sides of things. So it happened very sort of smoothly on my end. I mean, I was panicked the night before I directed my first film. I was crying. But
I've heard that tale before.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And even to this day, you know, walking on set, I've directed more films than I can count. And I still, you know, have that fear of,
I think it's, but also do you think it's, I mean, it's a kind of, I think it's a normal thing for people in creative. I mean, I remember hearing the BAFTA lecture from Scott Frank and him saying he was afraid of the blank page. And I'm thinking, Scott Frank's afraid of the blank page. How's that possible?
It, you know, it's funny, like on the one hand, I'm always trying something new. Like the last film I directed was literally a musical. I've directed stage plays, but I've never directed, and I've been in musicals. I've never directed a musical specifically. Mm-hmm. I was also the choreographer. It was also half in American Sign Language and the lead actor was deaf. So amazing. I know a little bit of sign language, but we had an interpreter there, but I was still nervous. Like, how do I, like, my direction was going to be interpreted, which meant there's obviously good interpreters don't, you know, there is no room for error, but there is something called lost in translation. Mm-hmm. So I was just a little bit nervous about how I would be able to do that. I've never directed like on a via like that. Mm-hmm. It was also a crew that I'd never worked with before. And I was a little nervous. I was brought in by the producer to direct this. So it wasn't my DP. It wasn't my, you know, grips or gaffer or anybody. Like, I'd never met these people before. And it wasn't one of the actresses I'd worked with before. But I'd never met any of the other cast before. And it was just a little, you know, like, I don't want to let these people down. I have the added benefit, I say very facetiously, of being a fairly young looking female who presents fairly feminine. I wear feminine clothing. I don't necessarily think about it. And with my crew, they're used to me. Like, they know who I am. I walked on set and all these guys thought I was either the set dresser or an actress. And when I started having the first production meeting of the day and I'm like going over the shots, they're like looking at me a little confused. And I'm like in my head, like, just keep going. Don't think about it, whatever. And then finally, one of them says something. They're like, I'm so sorry, but who are you? I was like, I'm the director.
Like, oh my God.
Everybody was like, oh, and the producer was like, I literally just introduced her. Like, what are you, like, what? So there's always something new to be scared of, which, and you know, being a director, being a producer, it's on you. Mm. And I think if you're not at least aware of that responsibility, if you're not walking onto set conscientious of the people that are counting on you. And if you're just a little flippant about it, or you're not, you know, you don't have to be scared. You can face it, you know, comfortably, but you should still understand sort of the gravitas of the position that you're in. And that can be a little scary if you stop to think about it. I mean, my hands still sweat before a film screening. I've been to hundreds of them, and I still freak out before a premiere.
This is the bit that surprised me. I was speaking to the director, Travis Stevens. I was doing the media wall at Fright Fest, the horror film festival. And he's a veteran of the festival. You know, he's come over from California to premiere his films. And it was his latest film, and I was interviewing him, and he just went, "I can't think right now." The interview just collapsed, you know, because he was like, the premiere was happening within the next hour, you know, and I hadn't realized how much that might just take up your head, you know, might completely take you over with the anticipation.
Yeah. My husband has to straight, like, push me out of the house. Like, as I'm getting ready, after a while, he knows to ask me, like, "Are you actually not ready to go, or are you just not leaving?" And I'll be like, "I'm just not leaving." And he's like, "All right, let's get in the car. Like, you're ready. Let's go." Like, it's, but I don't know. I think, I remember, when I was much, much younger and I just moved to LA, and I was working with someone who, now that I think about it, she probably was my age now, as old as I am now.
Yeah.
But, she was, you know, an older, like, you know, as old as my mom, but she was just so unimpressed by everything and almost bored with it, and just didn't, like, there were so many, like, she was talking about some things and my eyes were just like popping out of my head. I mean, I'd been in LA for less than a year, but I was like, what? And I remember being very conscientious and thinking to myself, never lose that. Never lose this excitement and joy and thrill. And I'm like, I don't ever want to be that bored or bitter, or so I guess they might go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I remember the first time I walked onto a film set and the last time I walked onto a film set, and, you know, seeing the camera getting set up and the C-stands come out and the lighting come up and the, you know, art department coming in, like, it gives me the same rush as it did the first time I ever walked onto Basecamp, like,
brilliant,
almost 20 years ago, over 20 years ago. So it, I don't know. I think in order to keep that excitement, I mean, I've been to Sundance for a decade, and every time I walk on Main Street, I'm always like, like, it's, I don't know. I think in order to keep that excitement, you also kind of have to keep a little bit of the, oh my gosh.
Like, no, I totally agree. I mean, I've been going to Cannes Film Festival since 2011. And every time you first walk on the Quisette and it's a sunny day, it's hard not to imagine, you know, the pictures you've grown up seeing of movie stars on that red carpet, you know?
Yeah, totally. That's a bucket list item for me.
You're now on the East Coast, and you talked a lot there about your initial years in California. What do you remember what the big transition was moving work to the East Coast, and what's the different film world like on the East Coast to the West Coast?
Oh, I'm actually from New York.
Okay.
So
I didn't want to presume it, but I figured from your accent, but yes, go on.
Yeah. I definitely mute it a little bit, because when I got to LA, people thought that I was very aggressive and I was very confused, but it was just my New York accent was a little bit much. So I try to tone it down. But yeah, no, I moved to LA. I basically had like an internship opportunity when I was 16, and my parents were amazing and let me go. So, move out of LA was multifaceted. I was not doing well in life. It was about a year after, I guess it was 2 years after I'd first gotten sick. Okay. And I was medically stable enough to not be like at my doctor's office three times a week, okay, which is where I started.
Wowza.
And I had an amazing career starting. I was working with that production company and was on a pretty incredible path as far as like the promotions and things available to me and the opportunities available to me. I was traveling constantly. I was working all over the West Coast, and they held my job for about a year. And then after a year, both my doctor was like, you're never going to be able to go back to that. And they were like, we love you, but we can't just keep holding this. So, I was kind of tail spinning a little bit. And one of my best friends, who I've literally known since I was about 12 years old, had just moved to Virginia, and she was like, you need to get out of LA. It's not, LA can be a very fun and exciting place to visit. Mm-hmm. It can be thrilling if you're like actually in Hollywood with like a studio job on a salary, 9 to 5, whatever.
Yeah.
But even that, shows get picked up and dropped and canceled like off it so often that even those on like steady series, eventually they're out of work. They've got to find a new job. Unless you're working like for the studio proper. But even then, like I have a friend who works in PR at Sony, and she is if she's not on a show, then she's waiting for the next show to come along or for her to get reassigned to the next show.
Got you.
Anyway, that was a very long way of saying that I was definitely doing the opposite of soul searching. I probably should have been soul searching, but I was just kind of tail spinning. And one of my best friends from New York said, look, come out, stay with me for a little bit. Her and her husband at the time had just moved to Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. She was like, you can help me with some social media stuff. You can like, film for me. You can, take pictures. Like, I'll hire you. Just, you need to get out of LA. And she was right. About 2 months later, I started texting with my husband. We started dating about 3 or 4 months after that. I started Space Dream Productions literally in her living room.
Oh, amazing.
Names on the Wall was written by Nick, her husband at the time. And literally Nick and I ended up co-producing that together later. He's still a part of the company. He's one of the partners in Space Dream Productions now. So moving back to the East Coast was kind of, I guess, just what I needed at the time.
Yeah.
A couple months later, I got sober. It was a big sort of
turning point. Sounds amazing. Life-changing experience. I mean, it's sort of a combination of needs most, and then opportunity came at the same time. Sounds amazing.
Yeah. We went to our first Sundance 2014 right after that. To anyone who's looking at becoming sober, don't do it 3 weeks before Sundance, because that is very hard.
So then what should we be looking forward to or looking to find most recently now from Space Dream Productions? What can we be looking for? What's the latest?
Oh, that's a great question. So the musical that we just wrapped, Love of Music, it's just a really sweet story. It's about a girl who has really struggling with anxiety, and there's a really nasty bully in her class who just does not have any compassion at all. But she loves music so much. She kind of like is caught in this conflict. And she meets a friend who also loves music, who happens to be deaf. And he kind of inspires her to, forget the haters and chase her dreams. So I'm really excited about that one. It's set to premiere in Orlando on September 14th.
Congratulations.
So I don't know when this is coming out.
Not long after that.
Okay. So it'll by the time this airs, it will have premiered. It will, it was made for a film contest with the, a local independent filmmaking chapter there. And, we'll see what happens. They're supposed to be announcing the nominations today, actually. So, we'll see if it, becomes my 20th best picture. Fingers crossed.
So what feature films can people, you mentioned, what was the one that's on Amazon, did you say? What films?
Amazon. So Names on the Wall is on Amazon.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we have two features currently in post. One is called Catching the Light.
Yeah.
And one is called Reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those, if I don't get them finished by the end of this year, I don't know what I'm going to do. No, they've both been a little bit of a wild ride, but between, yeah, COVID and strikes and everything. But both of those should be coming out next. And then we also just finished a short, also in ASL. It was, all my films have been in ASL this year, called The Heist, which is also a short for the Easter Seals Disability Film Challenge. And then we have four other feature films in development currently. One of them is called Dancing Beyond, and we just released a sizzle trailer for it. One of them, I was actually written by a UK writer in collaboration with an author from Italy. So we're really excited about that one.
Who's the writer?
Her name's Sarah Daly.
Okay, cool.
I don't know if you've ever heard of Hex Media. They're
Sarah's been on the podcast. I was trying to think.
Oh, really?
I was trying to think. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I absolutely adore her.
She's lovely.
Favorite people. Yeah. Oh, she's incredible. I'll have to tell her. It's written by Sarah Daly. And then we have a psychological thriller of our own called One Fine Day.
Mm-hmm.
A dramedy, even though I hate that word, I call it an optimistic drama called Comic Relief. We actually received a $50,000 grant from the Big Sky grant in Montana here in America. So we're really excited about finalizing that one. And then we have a sort of mystery action thriller called 9/10 of the Law. It's based on the book by Claudia Haggadis Long. You can get it on Amazon. And we just produced a radio podcast, radio style audiobook podcast, where we present the book in that sort of like 1930s or 40s sort of radio play style, where there's like, you know, sound design, music, and different actors for all the different dialogue and stuff. I think the first two parts of chapter one are up, and then the rest of that will be being posted over the coming weeks. A lot going on.
Indeed. Well, look, thank you for sharing all that. It sounds very exciting. It sounds like you've been on quite the journey. Right then, moving into three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. There is only one rule you need to know, and this is for those that might not have heard it either. Cora has given me three films, and each film we'll discuss for 5 minutes. And at the end of 5 minutes, we will hear this sound. You can hear that okay at your end?
Oh, goodness, can I? Yes.
First off the bat, I'm doing them in the order you get. I got the list. So first off is 1992's Walt Disney live action musical Newsies. Do you want to tell us how that film found you and why it is has such fond memories for you?
All right. So for Newsies, I don't remember the first time I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember where I don't remember ever not knowing of it, if that makes sense.
Okay.
It's the story of a very famous strike in America during the Industrial Revolution in 1892. It's based on a true story. And it is about the newsboys who went on strike against some very powerful Industrial Revolution one percenters, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
William Randolph Hearst, Joseph Pulitzer, these people who sort of controlled the newspaper business.
Mm-hmm.
They would print the papers, they'd sell them to the newsboys, who would then turn around and sell them at a profit, you know, to the people on the street standing on the corner, you know. The newspaper tycoons wanted more money, and they didn't want to charge the public more money, so they started charging the newsboys more money. So they were going to basically take away the salary that these boys were making working on the street selling these papers. And most of these kids were came from very poor families. They were immigrants. Some of them didn't otherwise have a home. Some of them were orphans. Some of them had just run away from home, run away to the city. They lived in shelters. They lived on the streets. And now they were going to be taking away the little bit of money that they were able to make selling the papers. And because the Newsboys had to buy the papers before they sold them, they basically, if they didn't sell them, they just lost their money. So it was just a really messed up situation. And it was right around the time of labor unions forming and people standing up for their rights. And there were no child labor laws. And the strikes spread throughout New York and they ended up unifying. And as a result of this, created a lot of the child labor laws that exist today.
Amazing.
So I love the film because it's one of the like David and Goliath type stories where mm-hmm. the little guy stands up and wins. It shows the power of just because somebody in charge says something doesn't mean they're right. Just because somebody who seems to have more power than you is doing something oppressive doesn't mean it's right.
Yeah.
It follows my heart as an independent filmmaker and the idea that the studios control and own everything and you're nothing. And if you don't do what they want, you're going to fail. And I love that. I love the scene. There's music in it. It's choreographed by Kenny. I think it's actually directed also by Kenny Ortega.
Yeah. High School Musical, man.
High School Musical. He also was working with Michael Jackson on last tour. So just the dancing's phenomenal. The, song, the music, there's a line in it. When I dream on my own, I'm alone. But I ain't lonely for a dreamer. Night's the only time of day.
Oh, wow.
And, right. It's just, there are these beautiful, beautiful lyrics and, there's some very powerful, lyrics. And I think it's a piece of history that we don't focus on. You know, we think of, if you are of a certain color, of a certain...
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Ethnicity, that means that your life was a certain way forever for all of history. But we forget that, you know, in 1892, if you lived in New York and you weren't in that upper class, you know, super rich, you were struggling and it was hard. And the power that can come with standing up and saying no and looking at how bad it was for these kids that were out there. Anyway, I can go on and on and on, but yeah. I don't know if you have more questions. Or if I'm
no. It's fascinating. Given how powerful the story is and the like, it, at the time, it was the lowest grossing live action movie Disney had ever done. It was it was nicknamed by a film historian, Howard the Paperboy, in reference to Howard the Duck. But then on VHS, it became a cult film. Much in the same way. I mean, I can speak more to horror films. Like The Thing was a film that was critically and commercially panned when it hit the cinemas, and then on VHS, it got a life of its own. And now, obviously, everyone agrees it's a great movie. But so it's interesting. Oh, there's our first 5 minutes. Well done. How did that feel?
I wasn't sure if I was supposed to keep talking the whole time or what, so I was just kind of blathering.
No, please. I mean, it's your memories. If you've got things to say, I'll listen. The less I'm saying, the better it is for me, to be honest with you, in terms of the podcast. Okay, going back in time, but sticking with Walt Disney, we're going with the animated classic Cinderella with Eileen Woods, who I learned had her own radio show. She was the voice of Cinderella and had her own radio show from the age of 14. So
have courage and be kind. The story of Cinderella to me is she had every reason in the world to hate everybody. Mm-hmm. She lost her mother. she grew up with a father who married this woman who was absolutely vile to her and gave her two stepsisters that were just completely cruel and tormented her constantly. She then lost her father. And when she lost her father, she inherited nothing. Mm. And she got banished to the cinders. There is in the modern, I don't think this is in the original. I think it's just in the modern one. Her name was Ella.
Mm.
And they, because she was in the cinders, they called her Cinderella. Yeah. Or if it's just Cinderella because she was in the cinders. But
yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is that this young woman could have hated the world and no one would have blamed her. No one could have said anything to her about like, you know, oh, well, maybe you should be, you know, whatever. She was kind to the mice that lived in her cupboard. She, you know, but she also wasn't a complete and total doormat. Like the, she wanted to go to the ball and her stepmother said no. And her sisters were, you know, laughing at her. And she's like, all right, I'm going to make my own dress. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to go anyway. And, you know, yes, she had some help when her stepsisters like just destroyed her dress and her stepmother laughed at her and locked her up and whatever. And yeah, her fairy godmother came in and like, was like, all right, you're going to go to the ball anyway. This is how it's going to go down. And I know there's like the, you know, you don't need a prince and you don't have to be a princess and whatever, but if that's her dream, she got her dream. Like, who cares? It's okay. If your dream is to have a prince, then that's your dream and that's fine. If your dream, you know, if you want to have a princess, if you want to live with dragons, if you want to run away and live in the woods, like whatever your dream is. Her dream was to go to the ball and marry the prince. And she got it. And she didn't give up. She didn't let the world take that away from her. And I know that I'm like hearing myself talk and I'm thinking of like how easy to analyze I probably sound. There's like the whole... even just the music of it and the way the animation is put together with all the little like magical moments. And I'm checking something because I'm nervous that I'm going to make a mistake. Okay, good. Yeah. Just making sure. Definitely struggle with a little bit of anxiety. So I said this is going to be telling because my company is Space Dream Productions, and the line that I cited from Newsies involved dreams.
Yeah.
In Cinderella, there's the song, "A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes." And it's "A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes When You're Fast Asleep." And I don't know if it's just me as an artist or as a filmmaker or a storyteller, but like, you know, there's the quote attributed to Robin Williams, but it's from the movie where he talks about how like art and music, like those are all the things that make life worth living.
Yeah.
And I feel like the number one way to beat someone is to drive them down into apathy, like make them give up, make them feel like their dreams aren't worth, because as soon as they stop, you won. As soon as they stop fighting back, as soon as they stop trying. And if you have people who believe in their dreams, who will chase their dreams, who think that maybe they could aspire to be something better, and who fight to make a world where dreams are achievable, like that's just so important to me and who I am as a business person and as a filmmaker. So Cinderella always goes on my list because...
Finish your thought there.
I was going to say, nope, time's up. Now no one's going to know.
You've got that. You're perfectly at liberty to do so.
That was impeccable timing.
Indeed. Well done. I think it's interesting, though. Just some of the things, because obviously a fairy godmother is out of the story, and obviously that having a fairy godmother is in the lexicon. You know, the idea of a fairy godmother to come in and sort things out, as it were. I wish I had, you know, the expression. I wish a fairy godmother, whatever. Do you think it's at all possible to read it with modern eyes? Obviously, you were sort of at pains to say, like, if that's a dream, that's a dream. But I guess you were right. The modern way of looking at it is she had every right to be angry at the world, and yet she wasn't. And I guess that's the bit where you kind of can go, there's a resilience there. It isn't just about getting the prince or being saved by the prince even. She still saves herself in many ways, doesn't she?
She's the one. I mean, when the fairy godmother showed up, she could have been like, no, I don't want to go anymore. Yeah, or she could have just been like, she could have gotten there and been pouting. Like, you can look at, and it's hard because, you know, I live with disabilities. I'm from a world where accessibility is an issue. I understand that not everybody can just wake up in the morning and be like, oh, let me go eat my healthy breakfast so that my body is supported to have a good mental health day today. Like, not everybody has that access, whether it's financial or just in what they're physically able to do. And there are definite problems and struggles and things you have to deal with. But like, one of my favorite quotes is, just because you're given a cactus doesn't mean you have to sit on it. And it's hard because, you know, you want that vindication. You want that acknowledgement of like, yes, it sucks. And you have every right to feel like it sucks and your emotions are valid and it's awful. But at the same time, how empowering is it to tell someone, wallow in your sadness, sit there and be sad, hate the world. Like, you're not empowering that person. You're literally trapping them. You're putting them into a very toxic state. And like, of course, you know, there is something called toxic positivity. There is sort of like a blind optimism of just smile and everything will be okay. That's not how it works. But I, you know, identifying actual problems, facing the responsibilities that you do have in your own life and working to either get that support that you need or to advocate for support to become available. Like, it's a tricky line because you never want to remove the responsibility from society and from the world to not be a jerk. But you also, at what point are you letting the world win because you're giving up? Because you're going, well, you were sucky to me, so I'm going to be sucky to you. And it's like, okay, who wins here? Like, really, who's happy at the end of that day? Because even if you say you are, the people who live and writhe in hate and anger and the path to the dark side, you know, it's not, it doesn't work.
No. Anyway. I mean, I often, there's a band called Urge Overkill. I don't know if you remember them. Do you remember the band Urge Overkill? They did the Neil Diamond cover on Pulp Fiction on the soundtrack. So that's kind of their big hit, as it were. But they always maintained it took as much effort to be positive as it did to be negative. So why not be positive? You know, I mean, it's kind of, and not, it's not strictly true, but there's an element of, and again, like you say, you can't just smile your way through adversity. But when you're not going through adversity, you can choose to set the pattern for the day, even if it's only a tiny bit. Right then, let us move on to your third and final choice, a very different type of movie to the first two. We're moving into action sci-fi, I think, with Kurt Wimmer's 2002 Equilibrium. Do you want to tell us a little bit about when you're seeing this, how you found it, what's important to you about this movie?
So, fun fact, the lead actor of Equilibrium is also the lead actor of Newsies.
Indeed it is, yes. Christian Bale, I should have said. Yeah, our second Christian Bale movie.
You said these is completely different, and I was like, kind of, except it has the same actor.
Yeah.
I am a big Christian Bale fan as far as an actor of his, as far as him as an actor and his acting work. Mm-hmm. I was first introduced to Equilibrium by a director DP friend of mine who pointed out just the cinematography and the lighting in it. It is absolutely stunning visually as a film. The cinematography is breathtaking. The lighting is really, really interesting. They really use a balance of light and dark. And I'm a big fan of, I could talk about lighting for 20 minutes, mm-hmm. so I won't, but like the way they use the shadows and the way they use a lack of light as much as they use the actual light. There's very beautifully lit soft artistic places where the world around them is more artistic, and it's much more sharp and angular when they're sort of back in like the compoundy life that they live in the city. This film's, it's funny that you put this one last, because one of the first things we talked about was that sort of like fear and anxiety and emotion that comes with being a leader, being the director, being the producer. My most like impactful part of this film is the idea that you should be allowed, everyone should be allowed to have emotions. So if you're not familiar with the film, let me just say real quick. It basically is after World War III, the government decides that art, music, anything that stimulates an emotion should be illegal. Mm-hmm. And emotions should be illegal. If people don't feel anything, they can't get angry. There can't be war. Everybody will live in peace. And everybody takes this drug three times a day. It suppresses all their emotions. Through a very random turn of just stupid events, the head of like the police basically misses his dose. And it's one of these things where like everything just goes wrong and he ends up just missing his dose and the drugs start to wear off and everything kind of goes from there. There is an underground resistance of people who refuse to take the drug, who do have emotions. And when he meets with the head of the resistance, he asks him why. He's like, but you're not on the drugs. And the guy's like, no. And he's like, but you're not showing any emotion. And he says that as a leader, he has a right to emotions, but his responsibility is to control them. And that's his own responsibility.
Oh, wow.
And that is probably one of the most impactful things that I've ever heard in my entire life. And I don't want to spoil the movie, but there's an incredible, very, very, very satisfying sequence that happens when Christian Bale's character puts his emotions in check and has to do what he has to do. And it's such a beautiful film, both cinematically and the power of the story and of humanity. And like, what problems are we trying to solve here by drugging away our emotions? Like, at what point, like, yes, you know, there are some things that you have to like sort of lower the impact in your life so that you can do something about it. You know, like if I'm dying of pneumonia, I need to take antibiotics, very, very strong ones before I can figure out how I'm going to get up and go back to work. Like you have to prioritize sort of like triage things, but completely eradicating all emotions without just understanding that there is like, and you can say, well, not everyone can control their emotions and whatever. Like, I get it. That's a much more complex mental health conversation than I'm going to have talking about this movie. Just very specifically, when it comes to the qualifications of a leader, when it comes to anyone who has a responsibility, because everyone is a leader in some part of their life, even if it's just their own life. You know, if you're a parent, you're a leader of your children. If you're a teacher, if you're a little section manager at a store and you've got two people under you, like whatever your position is, everyone has some place where they are a leader, where they have responsibilities. And it doesn't mean that your emotions aren't valid or that you shouldn't have them, but what you do with them, how much they control you. And there's also a really powerful line where he's investigating, trying to get to the underground. And there's this person, he's like, show me where the underground is. He's like, I don't know. He's like, and he's like, I'm on the medication. And he says, oh yeah? Then why are you so scared of me?
Wow, it was like you rehearsed that with me.
I did not. That was a complete and total coincidence. That's two for two.
No, that's brilliant. Brilliant. You've got like an instinct for 5 minutes. It's interesting listening to, because I'd seen this and I'd forgotten that kind of element to it, because I remember more the fighting style and stuff that Kurt Rimmer the sort of established with this film. I mean, he calls it Gun Carter. It's a martial arts thing that he claims to invent in his backyard. But I don't know if you saw or read Station 11, the TV series. The nearest thing I could call it is a utopian dystopia, which is this idea of humans realizing that they need art and stories either to perform or create them or consume them. If we can't create them, we want to consume them. And those that, you know, want to express themselves, you know, without that, we're lost as people. You know, the idea of searching for resources or trying to get back to normal. I mean, I think it's interesting thinking of COVID. The first thing we all turned to was our music collections and what was on streamers. You know, streamers, nobody turned to a spreadsheet for inspiration during COVID. You know, nobody wanted to know what size engine your car was, in the same way that they did you watch Tiger King, you know, in terms of how that united people. It's weird. No, they're not, there's nothing rational about it. Obviously, you couldn't predict which would be the one that touched people, I suppose. But I guess you cannot keep that down, can you? There's something hardwired into our DNA, which says that we need either the expression of or the ability to consume it. I mean, if you took music off me, I'd be numb, I think. I don't know what I'd do.
I definitely, you know, there's always like that trite, like without art, I'm nothing. Mm. But it's true. Like I didn't even realize that how much filmmaking has meant to me, like in my life.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those kids who, like, you know, I wasn't like Dawson at Dawson's Creek growing up with like a camcorder and like, I'm going to make movies and this is my dream. And I've seen all the classics and whatever. I only went to the movies on special occasions, the movie theater. My family's not wealthy. It was expensive. We'd go, you know, on Christmas because I'm Jewish. So on Christmas Day, you go to the movies and you eat Chinese food because that's all that's open. And we're otherwise just home from work going, why are we here?
Yeah.
So we, you know, we'd go for like a birthday or like things like that. If it was like something special with my mom or dad, we'd go to like the video store and like rent a VHS. But I didn't, I didn't grow up watching every single movie that came out and I didn't watch a ton of TV. But like I found this journal at my parents' house that I had when I was a kid and I was reading it and I was like, what is this? It was a shot list.
No,
I didn't even know what a shot list was. I don't even know how I wrote it or like where I came up with it. My cousin was really into film. And like, I remember one summer she was like, doing this thing where she was like filming and editing, like in the camcorder, like she'd film a shot and then she'd go and then she'd cut and then she'd set something up and then she'd film the next thing. So like when you played it, it played like a whole thing. So like, I think I understood it having seen her do that, but I was like describing this like sequence and like these like camera angles. And I was like, where did this come from? Like, it just always been a part of me.
Yeah.
And the very first time I climbed up a truss tower, I almost burst into tears. I was so happy. And I'm terrified of heights, but if I'm sitting on the top of like a 50-foot truss rig, I feel completely safe. Like I have no, like I'm literally surrounded by air. I better have my safety hooked. You know, I'm in a harness, obviously, but I don't feel the same way I feel when I'm standing like on a balcony or at the edge of a building or something like that. And I don't know. I just, being part of this world of making things that don't exist. There's an amazing line in V for Vendetta. I'm going to butcher it because this isn't exactly what he says, but it's just like the concept. He says, politicians use lies to hide the truth and artists use lies to create it.
Mm.
And that to me is just like, you know, you walk onto a film set, here's a bunch of people who don't exist. These characters are not real. This space that we're making isn't real. This is a world that doesn't exist. It's all of our imagination, but it's real.
Mm.
And, you know, you create, I think there's a responsibility that we have as filmmakers to make sure that our stories don't take away from real life until we get like a WALL-E situation. Where the people are just like, their screen is their life. I think the stories should either be a relief for people who otherwise can't escape a harsh reality and give them something to hold on to that bolsters them to be able to live their life, or it should be something that inspires them or something that shares with them a different way of life that maybe can, I don't want to say like just inspire their thinking, because sometimes, you know, you just want junk food. You just want something stupid and silly and whatever, but something that helps people keep going, that helps them think maybe there's another way. I have the Filmmaking Actually podcast. And when I was talking to one of my guests about on that podcast about like what filmmakers' role in life is, we were just talking about it. And I said that filmmakers are ambassadors of humanity. And even if we're just ambassadors to each other, every single one of us has a life that no one else has ever lived and no one else will ever live again. And us sharing our lived experiences is what makes film and movies and television, film and movies, which makes, you know, movies and television and even music and paintings and drawings and photographs. Like, I once taught a photography workshop and one of the guys in the workshop, he and I both took a picture of the exact same thing from almost the exact same position. And they are two completely different camera photos.
Yeah.
Obviously, we have different cameras, we have different lenses, you know, our depth of field is different, the framing and composition is completely different. But the way we saw the exact same object, completely different. And I don't know, I just think that that is an inherent part. Like you said, people who consume and people who create, it's even people who just watch movies can maybe see the world a little bit different or learn something they didn't know about another piece of the world or see something a little bit different.
I mean, I was interesting you said that about the photograph. I was just checking then. I was checking my names there just so I got them right. I once saw a Pizarro and I think it was Cezanne or Monet. I can't remember who the other one was, but it was a side-by-side painting exhibition in the New York at MoMA, I think it was.
And
every single picture was almost like Pizarro got the shitty cloudy day and the other artist, it was of the same subject, but each time
different.
It was just obviously different. I mean, they were paintings, but you know, they obviously got different, they saw different light in the same physical space, even though you could see that they were of the same subject. And I do like that. I think it's interesting what you say. I mean, a friend of mine did a photography course and he said one of his favorite things was they sent them out to take photographs of lampposts. Now, that in itself doesn't sound fascinating, but if you just said, go out into the streets of London and take photographs, that would have been too broad a brush. But by taking pictures of lampposts, they actually took interesting pictures of London.
Right. Because they had to frame it around the lamppost and make the lamppost look interesting. It's why I love like going to a film screening where everybody has the same prompt, but they don't have the same, like either they have the same genre or they have the same, you know, whatever framework, and just seeing how it gets interpreted by all the different filmmakers. It's why I say that as a filmmaker, the only thing you can do wrong is not have a recording medium in your camera, not take the lens cap off and not press record. Anything else you do is just how you define the art. Even if you do it in darkness, even if you do it with so blown out, it's just these, you can barely make the figure out on the screen. It's all, and if you don't turn the camera on or have a recording medium or take a lens cap off, then it's, you know, no lens cap off, it's an audio piece. Don't turn the camera on or have a recording medium, it's a performance piece. Like, it's still art. And I think whenever anyone gets too into the weeds on the technicalities, anything beyond just like the general structure of things. But even like advice I give to screenwriters or how I particularly look at scripts, other directors, other producers might not want that or might want something else. And the thing is, it's fine. It doesn't matter because it doesn't, it's not going to necessarily destroy things.
It's not an exact science. I mean, there are objectively bad screenplays that are written. I mean, I've read some and I've probably drafted some, but ultimately, but ultimately there's a subjectiveness which somebody could read your story and see what they want to see. And that becomes a conversation to make it into the movie it might become. But look, this has been absolutely inspirational. I very much thank you for your time. Thank you for introducing us to Space Dream Productions and your three films that have impacted everything in your adult life.
Thank you for having me and for letting me blather on about my...